Hello, and welcome to New Books in Environmental Studies, part of the New Books Network. My name is David Fowser. Today, I am joined by Tim Jelfs, author of The Argument About Things in the 1980s, Goods and Garbage in an Age of Neoliberalism, West Virginia University Press, 2018. Professor Jelfs, welcome.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Let's dive right into this. This is an argument about things in the 1980s, and I wonder if you could begin by outlining the main points of the argument as you see them, and if you could give us some indication of how you wanted to make some interventions into contemporary scholarship, what kinds of problems you wanted to solve or at least address.
Yeah, thanks very much. So the title, The Argument About Things in the 1980s, is intended to identify what I characterize as a long-running debate about the proper place of things in American life that I think is traceable through the long durée of American cultural history, really from the Puritan era onwards. I mean, arguably, it goes even further back than that and can be considered an import into America from European culture. What I mean by the argument about things in American life is this kind of constant contestation over hundreds of years about whether or not the United States is somehow a uniquely materialist nation, or on the other hand, is in fact a uniquely kind of anti-materialist nation. I think this debate has animated American cultural discourse with varying degrees of intensity across the long history of the nation. What I want to suggest by adding in the 1980s to that title is that the decade of the 1980s represented a moment where this long-running argument about things reached a peculiar pitch of intensity in political discourse, and I think also in the scholarship on this period, both in terms of historiographical scholarship and literary studies. My own background is originally as a literary scholar, and the project started out as an examination of some really quite minute details or some fine details of aspects of literary texts of this period. And I noticed the extent to which they seem to be keyed into, engaged with, and really intervening in this same long-running argument about things that I think is so characteristic of American cultural history. So the book developed from a more narrowly focused literary studies work into a broader cultural history that considers both how this argument about things intensified in the 1980s and how culture and literature of the period can, I think, best be understood, at least insofar as it represents material things and does engage very closely with material things. I think the literature and culture of the period can best be understood as offering a kind of complicating intervention into that argument about things itself.
To help us position this more broadly, can you give an example of, say, each side in this debate from sort of deeper in American history so that we can maybe get a little bit firmer ground underneath our feet?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think the earliest citation I have is from John Higginson's 1663 election sermon, a Puritan preacher who was haranguing his fellow settlers. As he points out to them, "It concerneth New England always to remember that originally they are a plantation religious, not a plantation of trade. Worldly gain was not the end and design of the people of New England, but religion." So there you see, in around, you know, the middle of the 17th century, a frustration on the part of this Puritan preacher that what's supposed to be, I think, at least through the in the preacher's eyes, a wholly spiritual and religious endeavor, has taken on the hue of a kind of materialistic project of acquisition. And in fact, for a lot of the settlers, of course, that's precisely what it was. They were, had relocated to this part of the world, were dispossessing the indigenous populations for material gain. Perhaps another example from a much earlier period in U.S. history than the one I spent most of the book considering comes from the middle of the 18th century, when in New London, Connecticut, a revivalist preacher by the name of James Davenport organized a bonfire of the vanities, this kind of religious rite that is familiar from the history of 15th century Florence, but then was reenacted in the New World by this guy, James Davenport, who threw in, you know, any material things that were deemed excessive, from wigs and clothes and jewelry to certain books. And of course, there's a very strong link there to the period that I later consider, because, one of the kind of landmark social novels of the 1980s was Tom Wolfe's The Bonfire of the Vanities. And I think that title itself and the kind of prehistory of the importation of this ritual to the United States gives you a flavor of just how deeply rooted the argument about things is in American life.
And so you want to argue in this work then that this particular debate, which has these really deep roots, reaches a particular kind of intensity, a particular pitch in the 1980s. What exactly do you mean by the 1980s? How do we put boundaries around this this period of time?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I address that in the opening pages of the book, because for me, there are various starting points that we could look for when we try to ask ourselves when exactly the 1980s began. The period that I cover here spans really roughly from about 1976 to 1991. I start in the middle of the 1970s because there we have a decade in which the United States found itself in what was quite evidently a material crisis, as it was battling by the mid 1970s, and certainly by the end of the 1970s, a terrible problem with inflation that, of course, had material roots in the oil price and the various oil shocks that occurred throughout the 1970s. So whilst I demur somewhat on the question of when exactly a decade like the 1980s began, I suggest that it must have begun sometime in the 1970s, because it was around this time that we see a significant reordering, a reconfiguration of global capitalism as we reach the end of the Bretton Woods period. And after the Nixon shock of 1971, the United States goes through two further shocks, two oil shocks, which sees the price of oil spiraling as political events in the Middle East take a complicating turn for the worst as far as the United States is concerned. By the decade's end, we have President Jimmy Carter intoning on national television, somewhat similar to the Puritan preachers that I've already mentioned, his sermon about how the American people have learned that owning things and consuming things cannot satisfy their desire for meaning. So that is a moment I figure coming as a 1970s kind of segue into the historical 1980s, where this age-old argument about things in American life really does reach, if not a pitch of new intensity, then certainly it becomes kind of front and center stage of American political discourse, with the sitting president intoning in this televised address his message that, you know, the meaning of American life must lie deeper than things, as he puts it.
And then we get to, you know, as a sort of later boundary to this, we have George W. Bush, who will somewhat later kind of weigh in on a similar topic.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's a remarkable, evidence of the kind of discursive impact of Carter's speech, which, I mean, historians have examined in some detail and tended to show that whilst it was well received to begin with, it was quickly labelled as a infamous malaise speech of Carter, and was soon seen as a reason for his declining approval. But if you look at Reagan's presidential, or if you look at Reagan's rhetoric in the presidential campaign in 1980, he picks up on this kind of thing-focused language, and, you know, explains to President Carter that it was their shirts that the American people were losing. And the fact that Carter had obviously hit some kind of nerve, I think, is clear from the fact that once the first President Bush then takes over from Reagan after two terms of Reagan, if you look at the language that he uses as he accepts the nomination, then ultimately wins the presidency himself, he reflects back, you know, from the perspective of nearly 10 years later on the language that Carter used in that 1979 speech, and asks rhetorically, you know, have we been too invested in material things? It's an interesting question for a vice president of Reagan to have asked at the end of the 1980s, given that decade's reputation for materialism. And it's perhaps no surprise that Bush actually answers his own question and says, no, we knew in our hearts what really mattered. We weren't all that invested in material things. After all, so the book ends towards the end of the first Bush's term, and I end the book in some respects where I began it, with a speech he made following rapid U.S. victory in the first Gulf War. It was interesting to me that period. That approach to periodization, takes the story right back to where it began, really, with the messy politics of oil in the Middle East.
And you know, with these really fascinating bookends of people questioning to some extent, Americans' relationship with things through the 1980s, a decade that is known for its, really opulent kind of materialism. It's also a decade that is often associated with the development of neoliberalism. And, you know, that plays a crucial part in your story here. And I wonder if you couldn't give us a working definition of neoliberalism. You can keep it short or long as you like. But then consider, so if we have neoliberalism in the 1980s, you can maybe then transition into what were the particular conditions that facilitated neoliberalism's ideological triumph in the United States, at least to the extent that it did.
At the moment, there's a lot of interesting debate about the merits or otherwise of using this term neoliberalism. And I think the best way to explain how I'm using it is to say that I use it as a periodizing marker. The subtitle of the book is Goods and Garbage in an Age of Neoliberalism. And when I examine that period from, you know, the mid-1970s to 1991, I'm interested in it as a phase in what I think it's useful to think about as a longer history, the longer history of the age of neoliberalism. For me, what I mean there is the mid-1970s marked, the mid to late 1970s, I should say, marked the moment where neoliberalism really ascends as an ideology. And what the ideology consists of in quite basic terms for me is a way of thinking about markets and the place of markets in political and social life. This ideology, of course, had been nurtured throughout long decades of a kind of intellectual policy hegemony of a kind of Keynesian liberalism that was more or less regnant from the kind of New Deal era until the US economy really enters the crisis periods of the 1970s. And, you know, its ideological opponents refer to it as something like free market fundamentalism. It's a call for a return to ideas that we would associate with the laissez-faire approach of later 18th century thinkers like Adam Smith. I'm thinking about the way that the economist Milton Friedman advocated precisely that and was advocating precisely that as a member of what Philip Murawski calls the neoliberal thought collective. He'd been Friedman and thinkers like him, Hayek as another one, had been advocating a return to what they saw as a kind of a truer form of liberalism away from the big government New Deal liberalism of the middle decades of the 20th century. So, that's how I'm using it. It's not intended. I mean, I'm aware of some of the kind of contemporary debates about the use of the term. It's not really intended as an epithet or an insult. So much as a way of attempting to name a period in history when a certain way of thinking about politics and economics has been dominant. And I would also add that, you know, it remains dominant to this day. So when I think about this period from 1976 to 1991, which I characterize at times as the long 1980s, it's important to consider it just as a phase in this longer history of an age of neoliberalism, which arguably has still not come to an end.
Indeed. And so we have then, you know, as we get into the heart of the book, we then have this frame of neoliberalism along with the frame of, you know, clear material changes in the American economy and the way that these things are interacting at a cultural level and are sort of rendered through a wide range of texts. And as we move into the heart of the argument here, I wanted to sort of pull out a few of the key ideas and a few of the key texts that really struck me as I read the book. And I think, like, first off, the first place I'd like to stop is the film Blue Collar from 1978 as a way into one aspect of this conversation about stuff. Could you tell us about that film and how that fits into your argument?
Yeah. Blue Collar is a movie by Paul Schrader, who many of us know as a screenwriter for Martin Scorsese's Taxi Driver. And it's a movie set in a checker cab auto plant in Kalamazoo, Michigan, and focuses on the lives of three workers in that plant and the kind of strained friendship that they experience as they encounter material troubles of one sort or another, although not exclusively material troubles of one sort or another that we kind of associate with and clearly reflect some of the economic conditions of the moment. Two of the characters are black, and one of them is white. One of the lead characters is played by Richard Pryor, And the movie opens with him having various kind of beefs with union leadership in the auto plant. Initially, in fact, his main problem seems to be the fact that he has a broken locker and they refuse to fix it and attend to it. So I think initially we get the sense that he has the feeling of being being treated as a second class citizen within the ranks of the workforce. But at one stage, he utters a line that I think is really interesting in retrospect. That he tries to explain that it's not his the level of his wages which he's complaining about at one point, but it's the prices that they have to pay for goods. I mean, it's a great comment about the inflationary conditions of that particular period. He says I think he says word for word something like, it's not the wages, it's the prices. There's also a remarkable scene. I mean, the basic plot of the movie is it shows how the class solidarity that seems to be enjoyed by these three workers comes under great strain, partly around the basis of race, which is eventually kind of deployed as a weapon to set worker against worker in a more kind of individualistic rather than class solidarity based struggle. And what they attempt to do, these three guys, because they're facing various material problems at the time, various financial shortages, as they attempt to rip off their own union with only very limited success, because they find out that in the union safe that they break into, there's actually very little in cash. But they do discover that the union itself is corrupt enough to have had an illegal loan operation going on. They attempt to blackmail the union with bad consequences for all of them. And it's a fascinating cinematic depiction, I think, of working people under strain right on the cusp of this period that I'm interested in. There's a scene right in the middle of the movie after these three guys have spent the night partying various illicit substances, and they're left kind of hungover and coming down, slumped on the sofa in one of their living rooms. And there's a fascinating kind of articulation of alienation as they sit there and kind of muse upon their problems, including the fact that all the consumer goods that they've been encouraged to buy, the washing machines and the various domestic appliances, are ultimately shit, as one of them calls them, and just a means for keeping them kind of hooked on credit. So I think that's a perfect kind of exemplification of one form that this argument about things can take, where that kind of insight into the fact that the goods of this advanced consumer society in the late 1970s are recognized as both goods and at the same time as worth as garbage, just shit that we're hoodwinked into paying for to kind of keep the system going, even though these guys are struggling to survive within that system.
And so this would be a film that you'd say would sort of roughly agree with Carter's position that, in fact, that goods are not really the key to happiness, or that goods have been sort of overrated. And in this case, it seems that the goods are, to some extent, indicators of a system that seems, an institutional system that seems sort of rotten to its core. That is, the union is corrupt. They, you know, clearly the systems of political economy that can get them junk appliances in exchange for a lot of debt is not one that is going to bring anybody any real happiness or any kind of real human satisfaction.
Yeah, I think that's right. Although, you know, at the same time, I guess the problem I have with the Carter speech is I always think of it as constituting a kind of spiritualization of a material crisis, and you know, I wouldn't want to suggest that the guys in the movies are just kind of the dupes of a consumer society that brings no one any happiness, because they're also, you know, the exploited laborers of a system of production that was being put under strain because of the squeeze on profits as far as capitalists were concerned, and that was then going to lead, I mean, was about to lead really, to the acceleration of capital mobility that saw more and more manufacturing plant within the United States, you know, shipped either out of the Northeast and into more union unfriendly territory in the south of the United States, or else across the southern border and into Mexico. So, I mean, there's also this in contemporary political discourse, there's also this kind of nostalgia for that moment where there were still the kind of jobs available where people could earn, at least feel like they had the chance to earn the goods that kind of come to characterize the sense of the American dream or the good American life of the mid 20th century. So in a way, blue collar, I think, shows what it looks like and what it feels like for that system to start coming unstuck and coming undone. And yet, you know, for all that, I wouldn't want to underplay the way the movie depicts these guys' material struggles as real. One of them, Jerry, played by Harvey Keitel, has a second job outside of the plant. He's a gas station attendant. He's still struggling to make ends meet as well, and is unable to afford the braces that his teenage daughter needs to correct some problem with her teeth. And in a remarkable scene in that movie, he comes home to find her mouth all bloodied because she's tried to fashion her own tooth braces, you know, out of metal for herself. And that's actually the kind of precipitating moment for Jerry to make the decision that he's going to rip off the union.
So we have this moment of a real transformation in the history of capitalism and people's experiences within it. But we also have something like Michael Lewis's book, Liar's Poker, which really shows us a dramatically different aspect of this process. And this is a book that was, I believe, also made into the film or inspired the film Wall Street. Is that correct?
I don't know if that's necessarily the case, but it could very well have been an influence on Oliver Stone when he made Wall Street.
Can you tell us about that book or the film as you want to deal with those two particular texts and how they show us a different aspect of this process?
Yeah, I mean, they're really fascinating to consider alongside Blue Collar, right? I mean, if Blue Collar can be interpreted as a kind of depiction of the kind of dying breath of the kind of productive capacity of certain sections of the United States in the middle decades of the 20th century. The point being that, you know, as we hear often today, fewer and fewer US workers as proportionally are engaged in the business of manufacturing, of production, of actually making things. And if we set alongside Blue Collar, a book like Liar's Poker that was published in the middle of the 1980s, we see a reflection of the process of financialization that the United States economy was going through. And what has happened, part of what has happened subsequently to the industrial structure of the nation is as a finance, insurance, and real estate sectors of the economy become proportionately far larger than they had ever been. Liar's Poker is a nonfiction memoir in which Michael Lewis, who's gone on to write a series of well-known nonfiction books, reflects on his own experiences as a ridiculously young Ivy League graduate who gets hired by an investment bank just around the time that the kind of exotic financial products that would eventually lead to the disaster of 2008, the financial crisis in 2008, just around the time that those products were taking off. And, you know, he depicts a finance industry on the verge of becoming, you know, supercharged the way it is today and accounting for ever greater proportions of the US economy. He subsequently explained the purpose behind the book was to warn fellow Ivy League graduates off making the same mistake as him and going to work in the financial markets in Wall Street or London. He was posted to London for some part of his career as well. And he was shocked to find that this book, which he thought was going to be an expose of the outrageous successes of this emerging finance industry, was actually kind of read by some as a kind of how to get ahead in finance guide. And then he found himself having to respond to all these queries from graduates or soon to be graduates asking for advice about how he should get into finance. And Oliver Stone's Wall Street, I think, is a similar cultural document in a way that, you know, this was obviously intended as a kind of savage critique of the emerging power of the financial sector in the US economy. The Michael Douglas character, Gordon Gekko, infamously says, "Greed is good," echoing the words of Ivan Boesky, a Wall Street trader who was imprisoned for inside trading during the 1980s. You know, this guy is supposed to be a kind of satanic villain, but I think he was, again, to Stone's surprise, taken as a kind of anti-hero and a model for many to emulate.
And so what we have then in these two sets of cultural artifacts is we've got different aspects of this profound transformation of the American political economy in the 1980s. And this leads you then in the book to consider what you call the aesthetic rendering of everyday consumer goods and how they functioned and how they were interpreted across a range of texts. And you have a wide range of sort of examples to draw from here, including the art of Jeff Koons, the music of the Talking Heads, the novels of Don DeLillo. And could you sort of discuss what you see here as the aesthetic rendering of these goods and how this changes or perhaps how it stays the same?
Yeah, that chapter evokes a word from art history called rapography, which describes a representation of trivial things. So it's a kind of connected to the still life and its kind of repertoire of objects, the objects in a cafe, for example, that, that kind of thing. The whole chapter focuses on the different ways that these kind of small, trivial, everyday objects, sometimes mass-produced consumer goods, are represented across, as you say, a kind of range of cultural artifacts. And the point I wanted to make, if I could, in that chapter, is that I think artists and writers of the era were depicting the objective repertoire of you know, real American life in the 1980s in a way that's actually kind of far more varied and at times more skillful than certain cultural critics have given them credit for, and certainly more nuanced as well. I mean, I'll start with the case of Jeff Koons, who I think is a kind of a problematic case study for has been a problematic case study for a lot of art critics in later years. And I start with early exhibitions of his from the late 70s and early 1980s, where he just he'd present, you know, encased in perspex, consumer goods like vacuum cleaners and other forms of domestic appliance. And what I wanted to argue with Koons is that I think you know, working in the tradition of Andy Warhol, and perhaps working somewhat too derivatively in that tradition, that early artwork is supposed to put us as viewers in a state of genuine ambivalence about the, you know, the aesthetics and the value or otherwise of these kind of consumer goods. And I try to stress the ambivalence as much as possible, because I find in a lot of the critical literature at the time, which itself, of course, is kind of part of the broader argument about things, the debate tends to slip into a kind of binarism where we assume that, or we want to assume that, a writer or an artist is doing one of two things. Either they're kind of critiquing the consumerism of the age, or they're themselves, you know, falling prey to the kind of vacuity of the consumerism of the age. I mean, there was a lot of critique in the 1980s of the enormous sums of money that were that works of art were going for in the art market or in the publishing industry, for example, the enormous publishing contracts and advances offered to young so-called Brat Pack writers like Bret Easton Ellis and Jay McKinney. And what you see is with, I think, all of those examples, a kind of a desire to either condemn the artist for materialism or for kind of falling prey to the vacuity of consumer culture, or instead the opposite tendency, which is to insist that, in fact, what the artist is or writer is doing is themselves critiquing or satirizing that consumer culture. And what I want to argue in the case of Koons, certainly, and also in the case of some talking head song, and definitely in the work of Don DeLillo, is that I think a lot of the kind of aesthetic power of that art comes from the radically ambivalent view it takes of these things, that it does not simply dismiss them as trash or garbage, but gets us to think and look again at the perhaps surprising or remarkable beauty of some of these everyday goods. That's something I see in the early work of Jeff Koons, for sure. It's something I see in the representations of consumer life and supermarkets in the mid-1980s work of Don DeLillo in a novel like White Noise. You know, I think there's a genuine fascination on the part of DeLillo with a kind of peculiar aesthetic aura that seems to be exuded in the kind of from the mid-1980s supermarket. A lot of literary criticism of the period seemed to almost desperate to ventriloquize its own kind of anti-materialism and to, you know, position DeLillo as simply savaging contemporary consumer culture through satire. And to me, I'm not trying to argue that there is nothing satirical about these texts or they don't in interesting ways, you know, expose some of the peculiarities of 1980s consumer culture. But I do want to argue that their aesthetic power lies in the fact that they also take these goods seriously, and they think and that we should, I think, take the aesthetic representation of these goods seriously, not completely seriously, but you know, ambivalence is a key word here, and I see that a similar ambivalence in operation in you know, the lyrics of certain Talking Heads songs of the era by the late 1980s, for example. David Byrne was writing a song like Nothing But Flowers, where he kind of envisages the re-greening, the ecological re-greening of America, a kind of re-pastoralization of the American landscape, and ends up saying that he misses the Dairy Queens and 7-Elevens. And that, you know, he misses all those things have been traditionally kind of despised or traduced about everyday American culture. And there's a great line in that song where he sings, "If this is paradise, give me a lawnmower."
The ecological dimension to that, I think, is a great segue to another element of the sort of ambivalence about stuff that we see about goods, and I want to turn the discussion toward garbage. You know, one of the other components of the title of the work, and to do that, I want to read kind of a long block of text from the book itself. But I think it really there's a lot going on here, and I think this will be a good way into the role that trash plays in this story. You write, quote, "Garbage provoked the expression of a certain archaeological consciousness across multiple forms of cultural expression, as politicians, writers, and artists were forced to confront the personal and civilizational implications of emerging knowledge about just how long-lived, discarded matter previously assumed ephemeral would turn out to be." In other words, that garbage is a problem, that trash is a problem in this world of goods. Can you develop that for us and tell us about how we see these kinds of cultural expressions?
Yeah, absolutely. That's quite a dense piece of text. I'll try to unpack it as best I can. I want to start off with this idea of ephemerality. A kind of key current in the longer argument about things that provides a framework for this book is, you know, kind of what I've already mentioned in relation to critiques of consumer society. This idea of a kind of throwaway culture, a disposable culture, you know, the idea that things need to be discarded and replaced to kind of keep the motor of consumption running. My research showed that from, you know, as early as the 1920s and the cultural critic Stuart Chase, you have references to American culture's requirement to keep goods moving through the hands of users as quickly as possible and heading for the dust heap or trash heap as quickly as possible. So there's a kind of longstanding tradition that focuses on this kind of disposability, ephemerality of the goods that are used and consumed. And trash or garbage, of course, is, at least as we understand it now, is a kind of material renunciation of that idea of ephemerality. Because when we think about trash now, one of the things that we're remarkably and understandably and correctly anxious about is just how long-lived this stuff is, especially if we think about, to go back to oil that I've already mentioned, if we think about the oil-derived plastics that form such an important part of the material culture of everyday life these days, there was a time when plastic was discussed by intellectuals and critics like Roland Barthes as being kind of characterized by ephemerality, this idea that it's barely there. These days, we think the opposite. We think the problem with plastics is a longevity, and without effective recycling schemes, that this stuff is going to last forever. Well, it was only really in the 1980s that the long-lived nature of trash really was brought to public understanding. In the field of archaeology, archaeologists in that period first started excavating 20th century landfill sites and discovered that decomposition was hardly taking place at all. And the things that we'd been throwing away, or Americans had been throwing away for decades, were still remarkably intact, when the expectation had been that, you know, they would decompose organically. And then later on in the 1980s, you have high-profile garbage events, from medical waste washing up on the shores of New Jersey in the summer of 1987, I think it was. And then later the same summer, you have this kind of incredible nationally covered event of the Mobro 4000, a garbage barge with 3,000 tons of trash sailing up and down the Atlantic seaboard of the United States, unable to find anywhere to dock because the original deal that had been signed, I think the trash was, the original deal was that the trash came from New York City and was going to be disposed of somewhere in North Carolina. The original deal fell through after the garbage barge had taken to sea, and rumors swirled around about the precise nature of the waste on board. Bear in mind, this was in the midst of the AIDS crisis as well, and there was a lot of kind of public ignorance and anxiety about some of the dangers inherent in medical waste, which is some of what was washing up on the New Jersey shores that summer. So the garbage barge is kind of sailing up and down the Atlantic seaboard with nowhere to go. And what I argue in the chapter is that these kinds of events, combined, of course, with emerging climate science that looked at what atmospheric pollutants were doing to climate change, to the world's atmosphere and producing climate change, combined with marine biologists' first theorization of the existence of what we now know as the Great Pacific Garbage Patch in the middle of the Pacific, this great mass of floating trash, and NASA scientists' concerns with the trash that kind of remained floating around space as a result of the various space missions that had gone on since the 1960s, trash became a public policy issue, a really pronounced public policy issue in the 1980s. you see politicians respond to that. Again, if you read the speeches of the first president, Bush, and if you look at the 1988 presidential campaign, one of the things he attacks Dukakis for, interestingly enough, is for the polluted state of Boston Harbor. And this was at the time when some of Bush's own critics were saying that the garbage barge itself was a kind of metaphor for the dark underbelly of the materialistic 1980s. What I want to argue producers of culture, from artists like Julian Schnabel to writers like DeLillo and Marilyn Robinson, who published her first novel in the 1980s, is that trash and the things that are thrown away and that are discarded by culture and individuals became a marker for what I call archaeological consciousness. This concern about what it was that would be left of American civilization after that civilization ended. And I think the very kind of public profile of trash in the decade really encouraged this flaring of archaeological consciousness that I trace across a range of texts, which takes the form of a deep anxiety about the value of American culture and the sustainability of American civilization itself.
Now, this archaeological consciousness, which is, you know, it's really a fascinating way to consider trash and the way that these goods exist in space and time and in ecology. You do suggest that that Americans made what you call an uneasy peace with stuff. And you know, you discuss this through some of the work of Nicholson Baker, and you know, an idea of an epistemological respectability attached to everyday things. Now, clearly, the arguments over stuff, you know, do not stop, as they are a long running sort of strand of American culture. But could you maybe discuss the way that by the end of the 1980s, by the end of your period here in 1991, we do see some changes, or you know, this uneasy peace? What does that look like?
Yeah, I mean, one way to answer it is to just dwell on one further aspect of the archaeological consciousness that I was just mentioning, is that that consciousness itself has a kind of evanescence, right? It flares in a moment where trash becomes visible, like in the case of the Mowbray 4000, but then disappears when trash, as it normally is invisible, right? We kind of we get rid of it, we put it away in places that for the most part remain unseen, under the ground or in the ocean. So it's fascinating to me that archaeological consciousness and the kind of anxieties that the trash provoked and still provoke tend not to last themselves. And so, you know, when I think about the work of Nicholson Baker at the end of the 1980s, I consider it representative of a kind of a kind of peace that American culture seemed to have made with things, in the sense that in some discursive spheres, at least, including in scholarly work, there seemed to be a kind of significant move away from the well-rehearsed denunciations of the materialism of American life and the well-rehearsed critiques of consumer culture towards a kind of turn towards things and towards designed objects as worthy of legitimate scholarly consideration and even respect. I mean, this is the era when Henry Petrosky first starts publishing on the small things of everyday life, including a book called The Pencil from 1989, where, you know, he unravels in the form of this, he unravels from this simple everyday object to the kind of complex history of design and production. And what I'm trying to argue there is that this is the era when a lot of the work that the material turn in the humanities of later decades, that turn rests on a lot of the work that started emerging from the 1980s, work like kind of popular books on single objects, whether it's the pencil or the potato, or it's also a time when anthropologists like Daniel Miller start moving away from critiques of consumption to consider in a less critical way the way that, you know, consumption is vital to all our lives and the way it kind of structures various relationships. And I find Baker's work interesting in this respect, because it seems to me that his writing of that period, his debut novel is A Mezzanine. I don't know if how familiar that would be to people listening to this, but it's a slim novel that details the thoughts that an office worker by the name of Howie has over the course of a single lunch break. And what's remarkable about those thoughts is how a lot of them seem to be attached to or related to the everyday paraphernalia of contemporary life, precisely the kind of things that someone like Petrosky had started publishing on in that era. A lot of literary critics, when faced with this, this debut by Baker, wanted to assume, it seemed, that he was being ironic in some respects. But I wanted to argue that, in fact, we should read him as not being ironic at all, and that what he's trying to show is that, perhaps surprisingly, that, you know, intellectual lives of considerable depth and interest are indeed still lived among the paraphernalia of everyday contemporary life. And it seems to me a useful antidote, or Baker's novels of the late 1980s and early 1990s, a useful antidote or a kind of counterpoint to the popular denunciation of the mindless materialism of the era. Because what I want to suggest about Baker's work is it actually kind of represents a transition point towards a more kind of mindful materialism, where across these different discursive spheres, people start taking things and the meaning of things a little bit more seriously and respectfully than they had before. And in the scholarly arena, you know, that builds up into the material turn of the kind of 1990s and first decade of the 2000s, which in a way kind of cleared the way for my own analysis of the culture of this period.
And so what we have then is in some ways a very long continuity of an ongoing debate in American culture, and yet some very specific to the 1980s kinds of changes. Now, can you tell us about your upcoming work? Are you going to keep working on the 1980s, or are you moving into other times or places or topics?
Yeah, I'm working on a different project and a different topic at the moment. I'm examining the way that narrative culture since 9/11 has engaged with the notion of crisis in American life. The period that I'm interested in is really from 9/11 up to and including the supposed crisis in democracy represented by the election of Trump in 2016. This is a period in which it seems to me crisis discourse is more or less everywhere that you turn, whether you think about the national security crisis precipitated by 9/11, the financial crisis of 2008, or as I say, the political crisis and the crisis of liberal democracy or the liberal order supposedly experienced right now. So, yeah, the idea of this this project is going to be to look at the ways. Again, you know, I want to try to engage with as broad a range of cultural artifacts and materials as possible, and look at the ways in which everything from fiction to film to the new narrative form of the podcast has engaged with this idea of crisis, and the extent to which it's helped to I think problematize the kind of repeated invocations of crisis that seem so prominent in American discourse right now.
Well, we certainly look forward to hearing a lot more on that. It certainly feels like a permanent emergency. And, you know, when you think about the garbage barge sailing up and down the East Coast, that seems like an important step in the way to considering a world of almost permanent crisis. Tim Jelfs, Assistant Professor of American Studies at the University of Groningen, thank you so much for joining us. The book is The Argument About Things in the 1980s, Goods and Garbage in an Age of Neoliberalism. West Virginia University Press, 2018. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, David.